Hi, it's Beth, one of the journalists at Manx Radio, and welcome to this episode of Newscast. Now, this week, the House of Keys has been considering the clauses of the Assisted Dying Bill, the private member's bill from Dr. Alex Allenson, the MHK for Ramsey. They didn't get through all the clauses this week, but there were some really interesting discussions as a number of experts were brought to the bar of the Keys, and I thought you might like to hear the debate in full, starting with Charles Foster, who's a specialist in medical law and who's been involved in Supreme Court cases. He gave evidence to the Keys this week. Incidentally, if you want to listen live to the proceedings that aren't broadcast on Manx Radio AM 1368, then you can just go to timwald.org.im, go to the business section, and you can listen live while the Keys members are speaking. And the proceedings are also put on that website a little bit later. But let's go now to Charles Foster, who was giving evidence to Keys members.
This House, as I understand, it is being asked to endorse the idea of codes of practice which would specify approved substances for an assisted dying regime. And in order for that to be rational, there would have to be an evidence base for the identification of that cocktail. That evidence base is hard to find in the literature.
Thanks. I mean, I've given you an element of discretion, Mr. Hooper. I'll come back to you if we have time. Mrs. Christian.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Welcome, Mr. Foster, and thank you for your evidence this morning. You've obviously covered many areas that you have of concern. So my first question is, do you foresee any other complications if this bill was to become law? So just to tie that up, if there are anything else you'd like to mention. And could you suggest any solutions to overcome the actual problems that you, or the issues that you've raised already? And my last question is could you enlarge why Article 3 might apply?
Yes, thank you. Other things that I haven't covered, well, you've been very indulgent and I've been allowed to cover many things. I don't think there's anything which I need to deal with unless members of the House want to ask me. So far as solutions are concerned, I don't think that there's any solution to... I don't think there's any definitive answer to the legal and ethical problems which a system such as is proposed would face. Certainly, some of my concerns can be mitigated. I indicated... just before lunch, that some sort of quasi-judicial oversight of assisted dying decisions would ensure that decisions were made capacitously, that there had been sufficient investigation of prognosis, that there had been sufficient explanation of palliative options, and so on. That needn't be a formal High Court or other procedure. There has been mooted in the case of treatment withdrawal decisions in minimally conscious state and permanent vegetative state, the idea of multidisciplinary panels, which can be convened at very short notice, which needn't have any of the burdensome and expensive formalities associated with formal judicial process. And that sort of procedure would lay some of my fears along those lines to rest. So far as Article 3 is concerned, well, the literature on the circumstances in which people who meet their deaths by assisted dying actually die has some fairly unpleasant things in it. I mentioned some of them in broad terms this morning, but just looking at a summary of efficacy and safety of drugs used for assisted dying, this is a Worthington paper from 2022, the Canadian Association of Medically Assisted Dying Assessors and Providers acknowledges that patients who ingest assisted suicide drugs can experience burning, nausea, vomiting, regurgitation, nausea, esophagitis, gastritis, severe dehydration, pathology of the GI tract. In Oregon, annual complication rates have been as high as 14.8%. Patients are reported to have experienced difficulty swallowing or drug regurgitation, seizures, and have even regained consciousness after ingesting the lethal drugs. Again, quoting from this same summary, there's evidence that drugs used for assisted suicide don't consistently bring about death quickly. Time to death is highly unpredictable. Oregon cases with available data, time from drug ingestion to death has rose from 1 minute to 108 hours. 33% of the total deaths of recorded data have taken over an hour, 7.6% over 6 hours. In 2018, of the medically assisted dying cases in Canada with available data, 50% were unsuccessful by 60 minutes. So that's in relation to the ingestion of drugs. One is talking about lethal injection. The paper says this. Cautions needed in extrapolating findings from a generally physically healthy population to those with pathology based on toxicology reports. Up to 88% of executed prisoners executed by lethal injection had post-mortem blood concentrations of anesthetic in the blood lower than that required for surgery, and 43% had concentrations consistent with awareness. That means that some prisoners who are subjected to lethal injection do not receive a sufficient amount of anesthetic to be fully unaware of the dying process. But because neuromuscular blocking agents are administered, those prisoners can't move any muscle even if they remain cognizant and therefore appear to be unconscious. And here's an observation which gives rise directly to Article 3 concerns. Sime et al. Expressed concern that monitoring consciousness in patients who are undergoing euthanasia and have received paralytic agents is difficult, and unless properly monitored, quote, there is a risk that vulnerable citizens may be killed by suboptimal or even cruel means. And then if the person were aware, it's been suggested that the experience of death by lethal injection could be akin to suffocation or drowning. So observations like that could very easily form the basis of Article 3 challenges to individual clinicians who adopt those methods, and in my view also to a law perhaps under the auspices of a code of practice which endorsed those methods.
Thank you. Now, honourable members, I'm conscious that we've had an hour as per the motion. Miss Edge.
Yep. Under whichever.
Can we about the numbers?
Can we extend to hear the rest of any questions that we wish to put to Mr. Foster, please, Mr. Speaker?
So, just trying to sort of draw a box around it. So, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on my list. Is that what you're? Is that the motion you're looking to move?
So everybody's had the chance. Yeah.
Yeah. Five more members. Okay. Do I have a seconder for that? Mr. Glover, thank you very much. Okay, well, we'll get Mr. Hooper.
Mr. Speaker, thank you very much. I think we've heard quite a lot today. The focus of the evidence is around the legal implications in respect of interactions with European Court of Human Rights. Obviously, no one in this chamber is a legal expert. I'm a little unclear as to how much more value the House will obtain by another series of questions and another hour's worth of evidence. I might suggest that actually we don't, and we just progress with this section of the bill. It has had some extensive debate. There are other witnesses who are also here to give their time in respect of other aspects of the bill. I suggest we move on.
Yeah. Well, we'll go straight to the vote then. The question is that the remaining five, Mr. Thomas, Dr. Allinson, Mr. Hooper, Ms. Edge and Mr. Johnson on my list, the motion is that they be heard and then we move on. So that's the motion that you're voting on. I'll just wait for the clerk to prepare the vote. Although I do acknowledge Ms. Edgeworth to reply to the debate on the procedural motion, should you so wish.
If you don't mind, because clearly, obviously, Mr. Hooper's just proposed, Honourable Member for Ramsey, that we don't go with this, yet he was on the list to speak, so perhaps he wants to say he doesn't want to speak now. I don't know. What
we can do. Mr. Hooper,
or we can, after, can we move another...
After we've had the vote, that will be up to Mr. Hooper at that point. call the Secretary to run the vote when it's ready. So you're voting as to whether you should extend the evidence session. ten against, then we will... there are five names on the list, and I've had a message from Mr. Hooper that he withdraw from that list, so I now have four. Mr. Thomas, next.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. In the evidence earlier this morning, Mr. Foster seemed to talk about the process of death inside a hospice or another environment and how it could be, in some sense, assisted already in the current situation. You mentioned various procedures and approaches in that situation. Would our witness like to provide any comment on the idea that doctors are already shortening the lives of their patients and therefore to an extent, and therefore this bill will help regulate or legislate for that?
Thank you. It's an observation one sometimes hears. It's a curious one. If the evidence were that there was a lot of public order in pubs in Douglas, and the police weren't able to cope properly with it, would the right solution be that you take that law off the statute book and let the public order go unabated? The answer to that, of course, is not. It is, of course, no. It's a ridiculous thing to suggest. There is a rule of law issue here. If it's accepted that the presence on the statute book of laws which are designed to declare something about the worth of life are worth having, assisted suicide is one of those, the law of murder is one of those, the law of manslaughter is another one of those. Should those be taken off the statute book simply because... they prove difficult to put into practice? I would hope that anyone who's interested in the rule of law would say that the answer to that is no. So if there's a value in maintaining these laws as a matter of principle, there are ways of making these laws compatible with Article 3 and Article 8 and Article 2 concerns, and I've suggested some of those already. One way which has been canvassed briefly is the way that things are done in England. So by the continued presence of an assisted suicide prohibition, but the exercise within very carefully drafted guidelines of prosecutorial discretion, which means that... quote, deserving cases are never in fact prosecuted. That's something which would seem to do justice to all of the stakeholders in this debate.
Dr. Allison.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. I'd ask you one very brief question. Are you aware of the New Zealand annual report published in June last year, which was quoted as saying each medication method has a standard administration protocol to ensure consistent, safe and quality measures? As of the 31st of March, there have been no major complications related to the administration of the medicines, and all deaths have occurred within expected timeframes. That was 328 assisted deaths. So your statement that actually... you can never provide for assisted dying. I think I'd like to question that. I mean, you were quoted in 2015 after the House of Commons rejected the assisted dying bill as saying, in fact, no imaginable safeguards would be adequate. Do you still hold that to be true?
Yes, I hold that to be true. I'm aware of the New Zealand work. There's a striking dissonance between that and the... experience in Oregon and the Netherlands. One of the main concerns for legislators will be that of vulnerable constituencies seeking assisted dying when they feel that they are a burden. And the evidence about that is completely unequivocal. So looking back at a big study in 2007, between 19 and 65% of terminally ill patients perceive themselves to be a burden. The 2016 report on the Oregon Death and Dignity Act, 48.9% of patients whose lives ended under the Act cited being a burden as one of their concerns. A 2019 study in bioethics, 31 out of 62 patients with a terminal illness saw themselves as being a burden. Is being a burden a good reason for seeking assisted death? I don't think it is. What do you do about people who perceive themselves to be a burden? A civilised society, surely, and an Article 8 and Article 2 compliant society stops them feeling that they are a burden. It doesn't kill them. So, no, I disagree that the New Zealand experience gives a rosy hue to the experience of assisted dying regimes of the sort that you're contemplating.
Yeah. Ms. Edge.
Thank you. And just really to go on a little bit further with that, thank you. So when you say to feel like they're a burden in that, how has that been drawn out in any particular case anywhere? But how has it been identified that somebody's felt like they're a burden?
The studies which I've referred to are surveys of patients in these circumstances who have asked for assisted dying or are terminally ill and would be in a position to ask for assistance in dying. And you have the figures.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. In your opinion, in the United Kingdom, does the law fail an individual who is terminally ill, wishes to end their own life, but fails in their attempt to end their own life? And if not, why not?
There is inadequate palliative care in the United Kingdom, just as there is inadequate palliative care in most jurisdictions. The thing to do about that is to make the palliative care better. There is no need medically for anyone to go screaming to their deaths. There is always an answer to that. One of the matters that I canvassed before lunch was the possibility, if all else failed, and it is very unlikely statistically to fail, of palliative sedation to unconsciousness. So this is and then withdrawal of life-sustaining food and fluids. So an entirely painless method of death, which would achieve all the autonomy ends which are sought in assisted dying.
So what's interject? So why do 600 people a year in the United Kingdom who are terminally ill every year commit suicide, and several thousand fail in their attempt and left in a more miserable position? Where is the law for those individuals?
Well, we need to put a lot more money into palliative care, we need to have better education for people in that terrible situation about what palliative options are available. We need to make sure that there is never any need for assisted dying legislation of this sort.
Mr. Foster, thank you very much for joining us today and giving your evidence. It's been much appreciated. And in line with the resolution of the House, the business shall now be resumed, and we revert to the debate on Clause 4 and the amendments to the bill. Next on my list to speak is Mr. Hooper.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. I'm just going to talk very briefly to the amendments that have been tabled to Clause 4. I think the substantive clause is relatively okay the way it is. If I'm honest, I'm quite happy to support Mr. Thomas's amendment. I think that actually adds a little bit of clarity into this, which I think is quite helpful. The one question I have, though, actually, is around the amendment from Mr. Callister. So, in principle, I think I'm quite supportive of the idea of extending the residency qualifications. I think this was the conclusion that the committee came to when we produced our report. I think that makes some sense. However, I would draw members' attention to the committee report itself, quite specifically, I think, to paragraph 28 of the committee report, where this particular recommendation was discussed. That paragraph talks around the submissions from Mr. Callister and Mr. Smith, amongst others, indicating some reservations around the 12-month residency. The committee confirmed they shared similar concerns and considered there was merit in amending this potentially to 5 years instead, in line with other residency requirements that already exist elsewhere, such as the Isle of Man residential condition requiring regarding social security. That was quite a deliberate inclusion on the part of the committee, the reference to social security, and the reason for that is relatively straightforward. Somebody might move to the Isle of Man with no intention whatsoever of accessing assisted dying. 3 years in, 4 years in, they could be diagnosed with a terminal condition that then means they want to be able to access this service. They would be prohibited from doing so by the definition now in the bill, as amended by Mr. Callister. The social security legislation is very similar. You cannot access certain benefits, including EPA, for example, until you have satisfied what is called the Isle of Man residential condition. And that is set out as an ordinarily resident period of continuous period of more than 5 years, or a number of separate periods, which in total added together amount to at least 10 years. So there is an amendment to a different clause, which again Mr. Thomas is proposing, which I think enables a definition of ordinarily resident to be included. I think that makes sense. But our social security system has an additional requirement built in, additional kind of get-out clause almost. Specifically, that if you can show it would be exceptionally harsh or oppressive to deny you access to benefits, you can still access them, even if you don't meet the residential criteria. And I think that is what I at least had in mind when I supported the committee recommending that we support a five-year residency, was that it would come forward and be aligned with the sort of language you see in our social security legislation, which is designed to prevent people from moving here simply to access benefits, but also realises and takes recognition of the fact that you can't predict what the future might hold, and over a five-year period your life may change, your circumstances may change, and through no fault of your own, in this particular case, you could be coming down with a terminal illness that causes you a considerable amount of suffering. So had the amendment been worded along those lines, that had a five-year hard backstop, but also an exclusionary criteria in respect of an unjustified refusal where it would be exceptionally harsh or oppressive, I would be more than happy to support the amendment that's come forward. But because it doesn't, because it is simply a black and white 5 years, I don't think it's a position that I can, in fact, support. So, obviously, it's an amendment. I was not expecting to see it in this form. I know there are processes to amend an amendment, but it felt like doing so on the floor, on the fly, with a bill of this significance would not be appropriate. So, from my perspective, I appreciate what Mr. Callister is trying to do. I am supportive in principle of what he's trying to achieve, but I think the amendment itself needs a little bit more work. So I won't be supporting the extension today, because I think that is, in this case, the lesser of two evils. If it is supported, obviously, I would like to think that the Legislative Council would look to amend, to nuance this in some way, once the principle has been accepted by the House. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Member for Aaron Michael, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, might start by, once again, and I'm sure it's been done multiple times, but by thanking everyone who has written and contacted me on this matter, both from near and far. I'm very grateful, and as I'm sure my colleagues in the House are very grateful for all the correspondence that we've received on this matter. Mr. Speaker, I've thought long and hard about this bill since its inception, and these clauses that we're debating today are at the very heart of the bill. Despite my well-stated reluctance to accept this legislation, I confess to despite my well-stated reluctance to accept this legislation, I confess to understanding and empathising why one might consider ending the suffering of another human being. However, this is not a simplistic matter. We are not animals, we are not pets. We are humans who live in a civilised society where we treasure and value life, where we care for the sick and dying, where we look out for the disadvantaged, where we seek to protect and nurture our cultures and our values for this generation and the next, and where we look after, educate and protect our young. And this is why, despite my empathy with this bill, I find that the correlation between the value of maintaining and encouraging human life, of fighting for human hope when it seems hopeless, of understanding that for all of us, the risk of mental health issues or sudden and unexpected life changes or significant health problems will make the future at times look insurmountable. Indeed, impossible to reconcile when placed alongside legislation that allows us to take life. Mr. Speaker, scientists will often use the words correlation and regression as part of a statistical analysis, ironically in this context often related to medical purposes. Now, without wishing to get myself into hot water with the scientific community, and indeed I'm not sure my maths O-level is going to stand the scrutiny, but correlation is a simplistic statement of the relationship between statistical movements, and regression is best described as evaluation of the whole equation. That is why, Mr. Speaker, in my opinion, a failure to assess the whole equation, or indeed willful decisions to not want to talk about it, has led countries like Canada to have to face a constant struggle with the application of their assisted dying programme, and why in Belgium in 2022 a reported 89 people were given lethal injections solely because of their psychiatric conditions or cognitive disorders such as dementia. Because this legislation is not a simple correlation of ending life for elderly patients in their 80s and 90s who are nearing end of life, cognitively aware and capable in strictly controlled environments. Rather, it will signal the likely regression that will see this legislation expanded to encompass a multitude of scenarios. And indeed, Mr. Foster has this morning and this afternoon sought to emphasise the likelihood of that regression. I quote from ADF International in a published press article. Though euthanasia was initially legalised under narrow, strict conditions, updates to the law have seen Belgium become the first and only country in the world to have no lower age limit enforced for children. Belgium cases have also included instances where patients have been euthanized for psychiatric conditions, including depression. End quote. The arguments will exist about different constitutions and different judicial systems, but there is no doubt in my mind that this legislation, whilst purported to be simplistic, is not. It effectively opens the door on the right to die argument. It immediately opens up questions of fairness and moral judgment. And eventually, if passed, it will come to fundamentally change the way society deals with the sick, disabled and mentally ill. Mr. Speaker, whilst many people will, like me, feel empathy for the limited cases this legislation is purporting to resolve, they must also realise and recognise that this legislation is unlikely to stop. The legal challenges to come in the years ahead will see to that. I've asked myself one simple question. Is solving a problem for a limited few worth the exhausting moral dilemmas which will face society into the future? Is a change to our moral compass now going to be the start of a philosophical and psychological dilemma in society? It was interesting to read the Medical Journal of Australia as recently as the 22nd of April 2024. And I quote, and I've circulated this, Mr. Speaker. The Victorian Voluntary Assisted Dying Act 2017 came into effect in 2019 after a prolonged and fierce public debate. Other Australian states soon followed, and legislation has now been passed allowing the territories also to legalise voluntary assisted dying. Although opposition persists in some quarters, voluntary assisted dying schemes now command broad acceptance, or at least acquiescence, amongst both practitioners and the broader community. It is possible that the uneasy equilibrium that has been struck amongst the multiple stakeholders will be disturbed in the coming months by the review of the operation of the Victorian system mandated in the legislation. While the terms of reference of the latter do not explicitly mention it, one of the big issues that could require debate is the question of whether the law should be extended to include people with dementia. Voluntary assisted dying for people with dementia has long been controversial. It is available in some overseas jurisdictions, including in the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Switzerland and Canada. However, it is not practically available in Australia owing to legal limitations. In Victoria, activism to change the law has risen in recent months, supported by claims that people with dementia like other people, should be entitled to choose when and how they die, and that in severe cases, prolongation of life may exacerbate suffering. Accordingly, it has been proposed that individuals should be able to secure access to voluntary assisted dying through a process involving advanced care directives or substitute making based on prior stated wishes about fears of anticipated suffering. The extension of voluntary assisted dying to people with dementia raises serious philosophical, ethical and social questions that challenge the way voluntary assisted dying is currently understood, enacted and applied. Specifically, such an extension signals a challenge to the basic precepts of voluntary assisted dying as they had been agreed in Australia, posing questions about the nature and effects of dementia itself, and generates concerns about possible wider implications, including the destabilisation of the fragile nationwide consensus that underlines the legislation. End quote. Mr. Speaker, it is clear to me that we are voting for much, much more than the status quo of advancement that this bill implies. It is a much deeper and wide-ranging issue. You must be prepared to accept the consequences that will come in passing this legislation.
Yeah.
In conclusion, Mr. Speaker, I want to use this opportunity to confirm that I will be supporting the amendments to this legislation throughout the debates that do their best to offer greater protection to the outcome, even though I do so knowingly that it is somewhat of a fool's errand. I also want to inform the House today in advance that I will be bringing forward an amendment next week that, if supported, will mean a referendum is needed before the legislation is adopted. There comes a time and a place when the people need their say.
Yeah, yeah.
In the interim, I will be supporting the amendments today put forward by Mr. Thomas.
I call on the Honourable Member for Wishing, Dr. Hayward.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I only wish to speak about one of the amendments today. I've cautioned in this House before about being out of step with neighbouring jurisdictions about the residency requirements, and that creates a pressure on terminally ill people to travel to a different jurisdiction, potentially. And I was obviously a member of the committee that was tasked with discussing the aspects of this clause, and it was clear in the discussion that we were all concerned that people might be attracted to move to the island when their terminal illness diagnosis had come through, so that they could access our assisted dying pathway if it was unavailable to them where they lived. We actually heard the challenge that we might become an island of death tourism, and it's been mentioned again this morning. However, as legislation is now being framed in our near neighbours, it's clear that the reverse situation might be possible. It's possible to envisage, just as Mr. Hooper has said, that somebody who has moved to the Isle of Man with no intention of accessing this pathway is then forced to move away from their home and their friends and family in order to access assisted dying in another country. We will, in effect, be exporting terminally ill people to another country away from our own. That is neither kind nor compassionate, in my opinion. So, Honourable Members, I won't be supporting an extension of the residency requirements for those very reasons, that I think it puts us critically out of step with neighbouring jurisdictions. Thank you.
On the Honourable Member for Douglas North, Mr. Ashford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll try and keep it brief. Firstly, in relation to Mr. Thomas's amendments, I absolutely fully support those. Just to say, I will be supporting Mr. Callister's amendment as well. I understand exactly what Mr. Hooper is coming from, and his recollection of some of the discussions we had at the committee is, I can say on the floor, exactly what Mr. Hooper said. But I think that the 12 months that's currently there is far too short. I think that what Mr. Callister has proposed in relation to 5 years I can support, and Legislative Council may well decide to pick up some of the comments that Mr. Hooper has made on the floor this morning around mirroring what's in other pieces of legislation such as Social Security. But I think particularly with this piece of legislation and the implications from this, which is obviously much more serious than in relation to whether you can access benefits or not, I think keeping it at 12 months at the moment would not feel appropriate to me, and so I'll be fully supporting Mr. Callister's amendment.
Oh, Ms. Edge.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Obviously, I'll be supporting Mr. Thomas's amendments today, but there are a few things that really concern me with regards to the Honourable Mover of the bill on this clause and the comments made with regards to Jersey terminal illness capacity and impact on our professionals. I want to pick up on. So I'll start firstly, Honourable Members, with Jersey I don't know if many members will have heard the article that was, I think it was actually broadcast on our local radio station, but the cost to Jersey is going to be £1.4 million if they get their bill through. And there was also comment that it's £15,000 per individual, and that's an increase of 50% on the original proposed costs within a five-year period. These are the costs and that could come our way if obviously this bill goes through. And I thank Mr. Foster today with regards to his comments around terminal illness. I have great concerns about any doctor's ability to give somebody a definite diagnosis that they're terminal, either 6 months, 12 months, people live longer. How many people in this room know somebody that's had a diagnosis of a terminal illness and they've lived longer? I certainly have, and not only with one member of my family, but with friends also. So no doctor can ever say for definite how long a person can live, is my opinion. And I have real concerns that here we are, 4 million. That's what Jersey are saying. I think they said it was approximately 30 people a year. What could that do for our palliative care sector on the island? However, we've not had any debate or discussion around costs or expected costs for the Isle of Man. And here we are sitting as legislators, possibly agreeing to put something through, and none of us have a clue what this is going to cost for our island, the future, the very people we're trying to protect by bringing in the right legislation, the young people coming through, and how we protect in fiscally responsible ways. I haven't heard a mention of it. I was concerned that, obviously, as many members probably were, that there's 90 amendments to this bill, and we've had very little time to actually get the amendments in from the publication of the report. It's an over 200-page report that honourable members received at the end of March, and here we were debating it in April. How many members really have taken every piece of that report, considered it, stood up in here today and discussed and talked about that report? When have any of us actually stood in here with a report from a committee that government have never done a response to? When we do committee reports, our government, I know it's a private member's bill, but when we do any reports from our committees, government has a two-month period that they can then come back and discuss that committee report. Have we had that in this case, honourable members? No, we haven't. And I think you should really think about that carefully, because there's a reason there's 2 months, because it gives government the time with any report to consider it carefully, come back with amendments that are well thought through and they've had good analysis around it. We haven't done that with this. And I really want to, you know, focus on that today. I was also very concerned with regards to, you know, the Court of European Rights and Human Rights, and Article 2, 8 was mentioned, Protocol 17 is mentioned, Article 9 is mentioned. Does every honourable member in here really understand the laws and what's been talked about? Because we really do need to, because that's where the implications for the island will come from. It's the impact outside of the island of the European Court of Human Rights that could really impact us. And I'd like to think that every member in here has understood what's being said today before they vote for any of this. But the amendments from Mr. Thomas for Clause 4, I agree with. I've always had concerns around people and death tourism, which is a concern that the island could have become named that. As I've said, with regards to diagnosis, not many people or doctors can definitely say you will die within 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. I've got a good idea, but they don't know. And then the final point I'd really like to pick up on is when we are using oncology services from off our island, we don't have an oncologist on the Isle of Man. We have to go to Liverpool, or we do telephone conversations with them in Liverpool. I genuinely do believe, because of the restrictions around the GMC, that no medical profession professional working in oncology services or cancer diagnostic services in the UK will give a diagnosis of terminal to anybody in the Isle of Man. And that's a serious consequence for us when we're using tertiary care, we're using the professionals in the UK to help our patients who have a diagnosis of cancer. They then get their treatment through them. But if they will not give you a terminal illness, that has great impacts to many people. It can be financial as well, especially if people have got health insurance for a terminal diagnosis. We want to make sure all medical professionals are working with us with this, and there's too many risks to the island that they might leave the island, decimate our health services, and we won't be able to get the care that we require. For anybody that's not spoken to anybody that's been in that situation, I really do encourage you to consider that when you're voting, because you should understand that fully. When there are people that are given a diagnosis and they cannot, and they're still here today, and there's many like that. And I think it's real critical position. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Well, the Honourable Member for Arbury Castown Maloo, Mr. Glover.
As has been well documented, I have big concerns over this bill, but I will, like the Chief Minister, be supporting any amendments that try and look to improve the safeguarding aspects of this. And but again, as the Chief Minister rightly says, a fool's errand in many respects, because there isn't any guaranteed safeguarding. That's the lesson that we've learned from jurisdictions that have introduced this. So I will be supporting all three amendments with Clause 4, and I also welcome the fact that the Honourable Member for Erin Michael is bringing an amendment next week for a referendum, because the more this debate has gone on, and the more detail, and the more people outside of this House have looked at it and become aware of some of the consequences and unintended potential consequences of this bit of legislation being passed, I think more and more people outside here are rowing back from the position that they were giving previously. So let's, without any fear or favour, put it out there for a test.
Now, honourable members, an opportunity for those who have moved the motion and amendments to sum up, calling first Mr. Collister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank everyone that spoke today. I am a little concerned by some of the comments I've heard today around my amendment. Firstly, the committee discussed the five-year period in some great detail. The committee also looked at options around residency, and that again was discussed, and it was very clear that the legislation was in place, as Mr. Hooper actually outlined and the committee outlined. So I'm absolutely very, very disappointed and a bit shocked to hear from two committee members today actually voting against what the conclusions of the recommendation of the committee actually said. And I draw members' attention to page 5, recommendation and conclusion 4, which clearly talks about the committee concludes that the requirement for a patient to be an ordinary resident in the Isle of Man for not less than a year is insufficient. The committee goes on to say that and supports and brings forward an amendment to extend the thing to 5 years. That's the committee's outcome and conclusions. Page 9 of the report talks about the highlight and notes the exemptions. And the only person who's got an exemption on that is myself around the short title. It's very clear. But here this afternoon, we suddenly have two committee members who sat on this committee for 3 months, took evidence, looked at all of the options, the practical nature of this bill, suddenly now standing up and saying they no longer support a five-year residency period. I really, as the Chief Minister has already outlined in his comments, I really want this House to be fully aware of the unknown consequences if they leave this residency at 1 year, because I think it will put a significant pressure on our housing, our infrastructure and our medical services. And I would strongly ask members to seriously think about that. Forget the two committee members who have suddenly jumped ship for whatever reason they decide, and seriously look at setting the five-year residency period. As Mr. Hooper was the one who brought to the committee's attention, there is already legislation to structure a around a five-year, very clear five-year residential period. We need to protect our community. We need to protect our Hooper, protect our services and our community. Sorry. He definitely needs Blinken protecting, because I can't believe somebody would sit on a committee would make conclusions, and then two of them would jump ship at the minute. This is a red line for me. If, you know, if this goes down to 1 year, then the honourable mover of this bill will lose a supporter. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Honourable Member for Douglas Central, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And I see myself as trying to cause harmony in all of this. And we've now got to look at the 5 years and the requirement for 5 years, because I think there might be a mutual... there might be some misunderstanding about what I think voting for my amendments actually means in terms of the 5 years. So if I just... Minister Hooper... speaking in his own capacity, I understand, not as Minister for Health and Social Care. I thought you made his argument quite persuasively. Let's imagine somebody who comes to the island, within the 5 years that they're on the island, they actually get a diagnosis so that they have to go back. In other words, we need to have some discretion. I accept what Mr. Cullister's just said, which is that the committee talked about that discretion. That's clearly there in the committee report, and I understand fully why he might be slightly angry about that, why Mr. Cullister might be angry about feeling let down in some sense. So how do we bring harmony in all this? Well, if we support, as Minister Hooper, speaking privately, has said, the requirement to have ordinary residence regulations made, we will have a consultation process handled on what those ordinary regulations are. We will have, it seems quite likely that we will have a five-year residency requirement as being the starting point, given that's what the committee has done. Then that five-year residency requirement, with all the exceptions and the discretions and all of those things, will come upstairs for approval in this place. If you said you wanted 5 years, like, you know, I did in principle, to avoid all of this potential of relocation and tourism and all of that, you can get that. You can believe that you've got that today, because we're making ordinary regulations. They must be made. The government consultation applies because it's the Department of Health and Social Care that's carrying them out, so there must be engagement and there must be consultation on the principles and then on the actual regulations themselves, and then it'll come back upstairs. So, you know, I'm delighted that Minister Hooper first spoke on behalf of my regulations. I'm delighted that the consensus seems to be that they're good regulations, and I do think that they work. And, you know, by not supporting Mr. Collister's amendment today, you're just accepting that we need a bit of grey in all of this. We can't have it completely black and white, because what we're all trying to do is make things better for absolutely everybody in all of this, and we need proper process. And the case I've been trying to make is proper process means stepping back, having government involved, having lawyers involved, having the public involved, and the like. I thought Miss Edge's points. So that's what I've got to say on my own amendments, if you don't mind. You know, basically, I hope you will support both of mine, and I personally won't actually be putting it in black and white that we have 5 years at this stage. But that still is what I think we should have as our target, and that's just my personal starting point for the DHSC. In terms of some of the other comments that have been made, I did think that Ms. Edge's point about a government response was a really well-made point. The footnote to the Tim Ward Standing Order 140, you know, goes through since 2015 all the requirements for government response. And at the end of the day, Keys and a select committee looking at a bill is a branch of Tim Ward. So it could be argued that the principles in that footnote 140 apply here. So I do think that's quite a powerful argument that we should be looking to have the government response. We should know what DHSC are going to do. We should know what the Attorney Generals think about some of the legal questions that have been raised today. And then, if you don't mind indulging me very slightly, I just thought the witness we've had today in the Committee of the Whole House, and our questions from every part, every side of this argument, if there are sides, because, you know, I think ultimately we're all on the same side. We want to do right by as many people as possible, ideally by everybody. I do think, you know, it was a very good session. I'm so pleased that Mr. Speaker allowed it, with our support, to go on beyond an hour. But I've got to be honest, at the end of the session, I had even more questions than I had at the beginning of the session, and that's where I am now. I mean, we do have a standing order that allows Mr. Speaker to think through
you know, when we have all these legal questions that have been raised, what we should do about all of these legal questions. And I'm not going to cite that specific standing order at this stage, because we've got some other valuable witnesses that I really want to hear from today. But, you know, I've got to be honest, that Committee of the Whole House is a compliment to ourselves and to the witness we had, and there are lots of legal questions, more legal questions than we started, that I have now. And I do think, as we're all agreed, this is not a race. We want to do what's right for the island and for the people of the Isle of Man. We should make sure that we close off as many issues as we possibly can, and we answer those questions rather than leaving ourselves open questions as we go forward in that. Professor Edge's blog referred to, I think it's actually Dr. Akos Barun's opinion written under Ting's name, but that's another whole set of issues on the European Court. We have the whole issue now of Treasury concurrence and what Treasury concurrence really means for a private member's bill. We have a clear statement that practical issues, minutiae, are beginning to matter more and more, and we need to make sure we get the legal and aspects of the practical issues right. So basically, I don't think members would be surprised at hearing me saying this. I did lay out my issues and concerns in my letter of the 19th of November to the committee that looked at this, and I do think we are getting closer to needing a bit of time for reflection, especially given what seems to be going on around the island, to make sure that we do what's absolutely right for everybody so that we have harmony on this island as we move forward to the next stage.
And call
back to move
on Dr. Allenson to sum up late on the clause.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and I'd like to thank all the people who've taken part in this debate, and obviously Mr. Foster, who's come over to give evidence to the Committee of the House. If I can just thank Mr. Thomas for his contributions. And I think we've gone beyond just the clause that we're debating into far wider issues in terms of the overall bill, but I completely understand that, and really would like to thank him for his amendment, which I think does strengthen some of the issues in Clause 4 in the very key definitions of this. I'd also like to thank Mr. Callister for his comments and his amendment. One of the key things coming out of the committee was obviously some concerns, both from inside and outside this House, that the residence criteria for 1 month, when all the adjacent jurisdictions did not allow for assisted dying, might encourage people to come here. And that was obviously a concern also taken up by the Isle of Man Medical Society. I don't think, as Mr. Hooper has commented, this is a black and white argument. I personally, the 12 months is in there because it is the international norm in terms of assisted dying legislation, and it's done most jurisdictions very well and is held up to scrutiny. However, I completely understand the concerns expressed by Mr. Callister and by other members, and so on that basis I'm content with supporting his amendment to lengthen the residency criteria to 5 years, as was discussed at length by the committee. I know other people will have differences of this, but I think it is right to get this bill through. It is absolutely right if we need those extra safeguards and restrictions to have those in place going forward. I'd like to thank Mr. Cannon and join him in thanking all those in our community for their input into this. I completely agree with him that this is not a simplistic manner. I was going to say this with the speech coming up for Clause 5, but if I can just point out that more than 250 million people around the world already have access to some form of assisted dying provision. But there are two broad types of legislation, ones that focus on strict definitions of terminal illness, such as the 11 jurisdictions of the United States, all Australian states and New Zealand, and the ones that could broadly focus on unbearable suffering, such as Belgium, the Netherlands, Canada and Switzerland. Because Mr. Cannon mentioned Canada and Belgium in terms of the incremental change. What I would say is that, ultimately it's up to each jurisdiction to decide on its eligibility criteria and the safeguards around it. But those countries which have restricted provision just to terminal illness, which is what we're talking about in this bill, have not seen these terms extended. And no country which has brought in such legislation has ever revoked it. And that's over several decades of operation. I do understand his concerns that the slippery slope, this incremental change, opens the door to the right to die argument. However, it is our role in this Honourable House to craft proper legislation that provides for the people of the Isle of Man. And I do not agree with him that allowing for assisted dying for that small number of people on our island, where it would mean a huge amount for, changes in any way our moral compass. I think it strengthens this. He also talked about some articles from Australia looking at trying to include dementia. There is no role in this legislation in front of us for allowing assisted dying for dementia. Dementia is not classed as a terminal illness. People with dementia, by definition, will not have capacity either when they ask for it or when they receive the medications. And further, advanced care directives are not enforceable on the Isle of Man at the moment. What they can do in other jurisdictions is allow for the withholding of treatment, but they cannot dictate future procedures or active treatments or interventions. That is up to the physicians at the time to say what is in the right state for and in the right interests of the patient. So I do think, you know, if we're talking about incremental change, going from the really restrictive law in front of us to an idea where people would be able to have advanced directives for dementia is a step too far. And I know of very, very few jurisdictions around the world that provide for this, and none that have the terminal illness criteria that are included in our bill. I look forward to his amendment in terms of a referendum. And what I would say to honourable members is I would ask them to look at our Referendum Act and the huge gaps within it at the moment, and think about what happened with other referendums on the adjacent isle in terms of Scottish independence and Brexit. Our Act, I think, if we're going to use it, needs reforming really, really quite quickly. I'd like to thank Dr. Hayward for her perspective on neighbouring jurisdictions, and Miss Edge for her comments. She's quoted some costs in Jersey. They obviously haven't debated their proposals yet, so those are just indicative costs. There are costs of providing for assisted dying, but at the moment we have costs, and I hate to talk about money at this when we're talking about choice, autonomy and dignity, but we do have costs with people having terminal sedation and being in hospital beds sometimes for weeks, who would want and would, under this legislation, have the ability to request an assisted death. She talks also about the difficulty in doctors being able to...
Do you have a point of order, Mr. Glover?
I was just going to ask, do we know what the cost of this is? That's the question. Well,
that's a debating point.
Yes.
So.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. She also talks about issues with diagnosis and prognosis of terminal illness, and obviously those will come up in the following clause, Clause 5. And okay. She does...
I just do...
Is it a point of order? Are you asking for the Honourable Member to give way? Because I'm conscious that there might be a bit of misunderstanding.
Just give way for a second. Yeah. I'm just concerned about the comments about people that are taken off hospital beds for weeks and periods of time. Is that a concern to the Honourable Member of the House? Yeah. They're in hospital getting cared for.
Dr. Anderson, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. What I actually said was the Honourable Member is talking about the costs of assisted dying. I'm talking about the costs that people are experiencing at the moment in terms of terminal illness. And so you do need to compare the two. If you're going to go down a budgetary and a financial route, I'm not keen on doing that because I think that argument is far more nuanced, to be honest with you. And it is very difficult to talk about a cost for service that hasn't even got past the first clause yet in this debate. But she does make a very valid point about how you organise assisted dying and how Jersey will be looking at that in terms of the resources that are needed. But most of those resources are people's time, expertise, training, and actually making sure that those compassionate services are provided. She also made the very good point about capacity legislation being in place and training fully completed before anything like this could come into play. And obviously we have other amendments coming up in further clauses in terms of commencement that will look in the whole around these. In terms of the committee report, this was initiated by the House of Keys for the House of Keys. So it's quite right that it wasn't a Timwell committee reporting to the government, it was a House of Keys committee reporting back. And I think the chair of that committee did as much as he could to bring members along, give adequate time for them to look at this. And as I remind honourable members, we're now almost 2 years since I was given leave to introduce this bill. She also talked about the need to understand the laws and the impact of this outside the island. And obviously in several of the briefings that we held for our honourable members, we looked at evidence from people like Lord Falconer in terms of the way that this would be dealt with by the United Kingdom in particular. And their recent committee report pointed out to the UK government that they needed to start now looking at other jurisdictions in the British Isles if they were to bring in assisted dying legislation to make sure those were taken account of by the UK government and work with other jurisdictions that pass such legislation in terms of regulatory controls. She also mentioned concerns about the General Medical Council, and obviously that's something we'll come into in terms of regulatory procedures later on in the bill. But certainly talking to the GMC, they are aware of the situation on this island, they're aware of the situation on other islands as well, and they are keen to work with us in terms of that. And I'd like to thank Mr. Glover for his comments as well, which I think echoed some of the previous members. So I'd like to thank all our honourable members for their discussion of this clause and obviously the future clauses. With that, Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that Clause 4 stand part of the bill.
Thank you. Now, honourable members, we turn to voting. And for those following on the sheet, that's in the box in the middle of the first page. For those following on the order paper, these are under amendments to Clause 4. The question is that Clause 4 stand past the bill. To that, there are three amendments. Putting to you first Amendment number 12 in the name of Mr. Thomas, which is around informed decision without duress. Those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, no. The ayes have it. Aye. Division called.24 votes for, none against. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. Putting to you next Amendment number 13 with regards to 5-year residency requirement in the name of Mr. Collister. Those in favour, please say aye.
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 Those against, say no.
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 Aye. Division called. Balancing. 14 votes for, 10 against. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. Putting to amendment number 14 with regards to ordinary residents in the name of Mr. Thomas. Those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, no.
Aye.
Division called. Twenty-four votes for, none against. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. And now putting to you Clause 4 as amended, stand part of the bill. Those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, no.
No.
The ayes have it.
Aye.
Division called. Eighteen votes for, six against. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. We turn then to Clause 5, and I call on Dr. Allenson to move.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Clause 5 of the bill clarifies what constitutes terminal illness for the purpose of the resulting act and provides that person with a terminal illness is only to be treated as terminally ill for the purposes of the resulting act if the person is reasonably to be expected to die within 6 months as a consequence of the terminal illness. Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that Clause 5 form part of the bill.
Honourable Member for Douglas East, Mrs. Barber.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I beg to second and reserve my remarks.
Or Mr. Hooper.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. There is a straightforward amendment to Clause 5 that I am proposing. It is listed, as you can see, on the order paper in front of us. It is very much in connection with some of the changes that have been recently made to other legislation by the Isle of Man Treasury around the length of prognosis in respect of a terminal illness. The legislation as it stands currently prescribes a six-month period. The amendment in front of us that I'll be moving talks around substituting this for 12 months. The logic behind this is relatively straightforward. It is to align this piece of legislation with other extant pieces of legislation on the Isle of Man that talk about terminal illness prognosis the doctors are able to make. I know we're about to hear from some witnesses, hopefully, in this respect, so I won't go on at length, but ultimately this amendment is just regularising and aligning this legislation with other legislation that already exists on the Isle of Man in respect of terminal illness and length of prognosis. Mr Speaker, I beg to move amendment number 15.
Call on the Honourable Member for Garth, Mrs Kane.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I beg to second.
Now, Honourable Members, you all have had an amendment to this amendment in the name of Mr Smith. Understanding Order 4.74A, an amendment can be made to an amendment with leave of the House. So I call on Mr Smith to request the leave of the House to move his... and if that's successful, I will then call on him to move the amendment.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I do call on the leave of the House to allow me to move this amendment to the amendment. Thank you.
Mr Thomas.
Please to second. I know Mr Smith thought a lot about this last week, engaged a lot with the legislative drafter. I'm pleased to support that process, and I do think it would be right for the House to allow him to make his case.
Yeah, I put the... the question I'm putting is that whether Mr Smith then be allowed to introduce his amendment to the amendment. So those in favour of that, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against, no. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. So I call on Mr Smith to move his amendment to Mr Hooper's amendment.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. And I thank the House for the privilege of speaking now. I'm very concerned about the prognosis and indeed diagnosis from healthcare professionals. As I stated in my speech to the House on the 31st of October, having had intimate experience with my wife's complex health issues over the last 30 years, I can attest to the fact that diagnosis is fraught with difficulties and prognosis even more so, verging on the high nigh impossible. We must fight to support people when they are at their lowest and experience most painful moments. Regarding prognosis, I would just like to mention the story of a young lady on the Isle of Man, just to bring some clarity to this. And this she wrote to me, and this literally is on the Isle of Man in recent years. At the age of 20, in November 2014, I was diagnosed as having cancer. In February 2015, and having had radiotherapy and chemotherapy, my parents and I were given the devastating news that I was now terminally ill, as my scan still showed a lump. However, after 6 months, we were told that another radiographer had seen my scans and thought the supposed lump of cancer was only scar tissue. 3 months later, this was confirmed. Should I have been offered an assisted suicide, my life could have ended at the age of 21. However, I am now 29 and have every expectation of living a full life. In my situation, the existence of assisted suicide as an alternative could easily have led me to consider ending my life because of an inaccurate but terrifying diagnosis. Mr Speaker, I sincerely hope that members will recognise that, as I have mentioned here, and hopefully our esteemed witnesses will also suggest today, that prognosis, diagnosis is fraught with difficulty, and that a year, 6 months I thought was far too long. A year I think is over excessive, and I would like to conclude by saying that I wish my amendment in due course to be upheld at 3 months. Thank you, Mr Speaker.
Mr Thomas.
Please to second to have this fully debated. As I said, Mr I know Mr. Smith thought about this a lot, talked with lots of people. I know it was discussed with various groups of doctors. The only thing I would say is that I was a bit surprised to hear that we were looking for 12 months. So I'm seconding the amendment. I'm just surprised to say in the speech that we've already heard that that we were looking to extend it to 12 months to align with Treasury, Social Security type procedures. I hadn't, you know, this whole business of Treasury concurrence and what we're doing, what we've already done in terms of Treasury decisions all seems to me to be getting a bit confused and confusing. So that's, because I won't have another chance to speak, I just wanted to make that brief point as well while I'm seconding Mr. Smith's amendment.
Call on Dr. Anderson to move the procedural motion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. And understanding order 4.4a, I move that we resolve into a committee of the whole House in order to hear evidence from Professor Sam Almedzi and Dr. Jackie Davis regarding the diagnosis and prognosis relating to terminal illness for a period of no longer than 1 hour.
I have a second for that, please. Mrs. Barber.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I beg to second.
No member wishes to speak to the motion. I'll put the question that we resolve ourselves into committee to take evidence along the lines suggested by Dr. Allenson. Those in favour, please say aye.
Aye.
Against, no. The ayes have it. The ayes have it. Let's wait for the microphone.
Is it either of the guests, or is it? Are you doing one first and then the second?
Well, I'm going to let them fight it out between them as to who's going to answer each question, but the question will be put, and then I will give the opportunity for both to answer within the time frame that we have got. Welcome, Professor Almedzi and Dr. Davies. Thank you very much. If you'd like to make an opening statement, this would be your opportunity.
Thank you. I think we'll both make an opening statement, as our colleague did, and then chances for questions. So first of all, thanks very much for asking me here today, my first visit, very exciting. I'm a consultant radiologist in a hospital in North London, and my declarations of interest are that I chair Healthcare Professionals for Assisted Dying, which is the medical branch of Dignity in Dying. I'm an elected member of BMA Council and ditto of the BMA Medical Ethics Committee. And I was part of the group who did the BMA's work, which resulted in the report that you had here today. So I would just like to start with a fear that the quote that was given from the BMA this morning was not quite right. That the trajectory of the BMA has been very interesting. Of course, the BMA was opposed for a long time. And some of us felt that that was due to a minority of people who spoke up very passionately against this, and so we fought to get a survey, and the survey showed, as we expected, that there's a broad spectrum across the medical profession of people who are opposed to assisted dying, people who aren't really sure, and people who are very willing to support it. And in our survey, the number of people who wanted the BMA to move from its opposition outnumbered the people who wanted to remain opposed, which is why the BMA has moved to neutral, which of course allows it now to comment on legislation about assisted dying. The statement that was made this morning about the BMA's position, I might not have quite caught it properly, but what the BMA say is that doctors who want to assist their own patients could do so if they opt into the system. And the BMA has called for an opt-in system for doctors. So there would be just natural conscientious objection: if you don't opt in, you're not asked to do it. But it's equally important, I would suggest, that there's conscientious participation for doctors who do want to do it, that they are protected and trained in this and encouraged to do it. So the BMA's position was not quite as stated this morning, that doctors who want to do this can assist their own patients. They'll have to be opt-in doctors about that. I have been a frontline doctor all my professional life, so I hope you don't mind if I challenge a few of the clinical things that were said this morning. And which I would have to disagree with about clinical practice and patients made by Mr. Foster, the first witness. He talked about the doctor-patient relationship. The BMA did a big piece of work on the doctor-patient relationship, and I was also part of that piece of work. They consulted doctors and patients, and the vast majority of patients think that assisted dying legislation would improve the doctor-patient relationship. There was no talk about being fearful about your doctor. It was, we can have better conversations at the end of life if this legislation is in place. So it's not right that the evidence is that the doctor-patient relationship is not in any way compromised, and in fact it improves if assisted dying legislation is introduced. I will come to prognosis in a minute, but there are a couple of other things that were said that I was worried about. There was talk about patients feeling a burden, and that is information that has been taken from doctors after the patient died, not from the patients themselves at the time. Now, we know that everybody who's terminally ill, needs a lot of attention, feels a burden, and some of them accept assisted dying, and some of them don't want that. So that's not a patient judgment on why they accepted assisted dying. That is the judgment of the doctor afterwards, that it was something that the patient felt at the end of life. I think it's important to differentiate between those two things. My colleague talked, Mr. Forster talked about go to the ground. I wish everybody would go to the ground. I went to Oregon last year. I went to the first assisted dying conference that they had had since the pandemic, and it was an amazing occasion. There were 500 people there, all of them involved in assisted dying. It sounds like a lot of people, but they have a system of doulas, of course, which you won't have here, but many people who volunteer to sit with the families at the bedside at the end of life. And it was about people just saying, we've got the legislation, how can we make this better for patients? How can we make it better for doctors who are involved in it, and how can we make sure the safeguards stay in place and there's no deviation? They talked about the drugs, and my colleague will talk about that. But what happens in these places is that once the legislation is introduced, people just get on with it. All the fears that we hear about, and they're reasonable, don't materialise. Never been any question in Oregon about vulnerable people. In fact, what we know is that it's the families who try to coerce the patients to stay alive longer than they want to, that they encourage them to have treatments that they don't want when the patients are ready to go. So there's never been any evidence about that. There's been no slippery slope in Oregon. I think somebody said it's really important. The law you pass is the law that you get, and the evidence is if you pass the Oregon-type law, you don't get any slippery slope at the end of it all. The other interesting thing is that when legislation is introduced, in fact, the number of doctors who are prepared to participate in it goes up because they see that it's safe, they see that patients, it's compassionate choice for patients, and they see that actually it's a good thing to get involved with because they want to follow their patients through with it. I'm not going to try and address some statements about cocktails of drugs, time variation. I think it's important to say that in Oregon, the median time to unconsciousness is 5 minutes, and the median time to death is 30 minutes. And there was a lot of discussion in Oregon about their constant looking at the drugs they use, talking to each other. And a very interesting innovation in the States is the American Academy for Medical Aid in Dying, which is set up like a royal college, so that people who are involved in assisted dying are in constant communication about improving things, about the drugs that they use, and very important that doctors are involved right until the end. I want to say about prognosis, of course. The problem with prognosis is, and I'm sure we're going to look at this in great detail, but for me the important thing about prognosis is that these patients who are seeking assisted dying are not suicidal. And that's why the term assisted suicide is wrong, and it's so unkind to them, and their families don't like it either, because there's something pejorative about suicide. There was a young woman in California, I don't know whether any of you have come across her case, called Brittany Maynard, very young, very beautiful, very on social media, and she was just married, and then she was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumour. And she was told that they might be able to prolong her life a bit, that she was going to die. And she started blogging in California about it. And she said, I don't want to die, but I'm dying. And that is the situation of these people. They don't want to die, but they're dying. She did eventually have an assisted death in Oregon, but only at the very end. So these people don't want to die. They do want to live as fully as they can until they die. And they want to think that at the end, if their suffering becomes intolerable, that they will have that choice of an assisted death. So it doesn't matter. It's a straw man, this business of prognosis, really. It doesn't matter if they live a couple of months longer or a couple of months less than the prognosis. And I have to say that as somebody who's spent their life as a diagnostician, which I am, as a diagnostic radiologist, I'm very shocked to hear that it's nigh on impossible, because that means I've been wasting my time for the last 30 years. Of course it's not nigh on impossible. I was a breast radiologist for many years, a very high degree of accuracy in that field. So it's not impossible, and nor is prognosis. But, of course, you might say, a month here, a month there, I would put it to you, it doesn't matter. Because you might live 7 or 8 months instead of 6 months, but you live 7 or 8 months in the knowledge that at the end of that time, that choice will be available to you. You don't take that medication straight away because you're not a suicidal person. So all the argument about prognostication is really a straw man. It doesn't matter. These people don't wish to die. They want to live fully without the fear of death until they have the choice at the end of their lives when their suffering becomes intolerable. And that's not many people. The death rate in Oregon is less than 1%, and it's been there for 25 years or more. And that's the law, I think, that you're looking at. It's the law that we're looking at in the UK. I would absolutely take issue with there's no suffering we can't deal with at the end of life. I'm a clinical radiologist. As radiologists, we deal with terminal patients all the time. And I can tell you, I have seen patients in situations that I would not want my family to be in, I would not want to be in myself, and that is despite the use of the best possible palliative care. Assisted dying should be part of that spectrum, and of course, palliative care should and does improve in jurisdictions where assisted dying is introduced, because they go together, they shouldn't be separate. So yes, of course, there'll never be no need for palliative care, and it will get better and better. But there's still that small residue of patients who will die in pain, who will die in suffering. And I bet everybody in this room knows somebody that has happened to. And I would just finish by saying that one death, one bad death, is one bad death too many when we can prevent it, because that's suffering. And if you have legislation, no more people will die, but fewer people will suffer. And I put it to you, that is the most compassionate way to look at this. Thank you.
Before we go on, can I just ask the Seneschal to move the microphone between to the location between the witnesses, please?
Thank you.
If you'd like to make a brief opening statement, and then I'll hand it over to the members for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, members of this House. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me here today. This is actually my second time to the Isle of Man. I was here about maybe 10 or more years ago at the invitation of the palliative care community, and I remember visiting the hospice and was mightily impressed. But I'm here for different reasons today. I will just give my declarations as well. I am a palliative medicine doctor. I practiced palliative medicine for 30 years, initially in hospice and then in hospital-based palliative medicine. I got to the level of being professor of palliative medicine for 20 years at the University of Sheffield. So I do know a bit about the subject matter. I was the first palliative medicine doctor to go public on my position about assisted dying. I published a letter to say that I'd changed my view of being against changing the law to now in favour of changing the law. So that's one of my declarations, that I came open about that. But a few years later, I was involved with another letter to the British Medical Journal. It was published by five consultants who anonymously wrote a letter about how they also wished to have a change in the law, but were prevented from putting their name to the letter because of fears of reprisals and recriminations, because from people, places they were working, whether it was hospitals or hospices. And we were representing a large number, we know, of particularly junior doctors who were being gagged and stifled from expressing their true opinions. So when we hear about surveys of that the majority of doctors in palliative medicine are against changing the law, actually, we don't know that, because people are not being allowed to speak openly. So I've come clean. I've said I was one of those anonymous doctors. But even now, the other doctors don't wish to, because their positions that they're in will preclude them. As a physician, I've worked in the front line for over 30 years. I'm now retired from clinical practice, so I still do my academic research and teaching, and I'm involved in production of guidelines and reports even for Parliament, which I'll mention in a minute. As a physician working in the front line of palliative and end-of-life care, I know the amount of suffering that happens in end-of-life for all conditions, not just cancer, but many other conditions. And I know how powerful we have now become in terms of alleviating a lot of that suffering. But I also know the limitations. I know that we cannot, and I say this to you absolutely, we cannot relieve all suffering, whether it's pain or breathlessness or other interminable symptoms. And of course, medically, we can't even make an impact on the other suffering, the psychological, the existential suffering, about the loss of control, the indignity, the amount of patients I can picture who lay there with large gaping holes in their body where their genitals used to be, begging me to put them out of their misery. That's the kind of suffering there is no drug for. And obviously, I had to turn away from that patient because of the law. I couldn't end his suffering. But I'm also aware of the limitations, but also the misuse and abuse of end-of-life care. And I draw your attention to two examples. One was the Liverpool Care Pathway, which I think some of you will remember was started off as a grand idea to take hospice practice and apply it in every hospital up and down the country, every care home up and down the country. Went horribly wrong. Complaints of patients having their fluids taken away, their drips taken out, starved and dehydrated to death, sedation put in. Actually, the kind of regimen that we were just being told about is an acceptable alternative. But we know what happened in that situation. The Liverpool Care Pathway was banned by Parliament. And that was in 2014. Last year, 2023, I was an author of a report from the Lords and Commons Family and Child Protection Group, where we were asked to analyse several cases of end-of-life care, which were put to us out of a pool of many hundreds. We selected 17. If I tell you the title of the report, it was called When End-of-Life Care Goes Wrong. And we showed that actually end-of-life care in the United Kingdom, even though we are proud that we are leaders in the world, can go horribly wrong. And in fact, in many cases, we found that the Liverpool Care Pathway was still being used in all but name. It was just brushed under the carpet, and that was right up into the sort of 2020s. So, yes, we are proud of what palliative care can achieve, and I'm sure the services here on the island are fantastic, anything like I remember them from many years ago. But we can't be sure they always will be. And I know that numerically across, you know, the whole of the United Kingdom, many patients are being disserved, not just underserved because of lack of funding, but disserved by palliative care, which is not delivering the goods for them as well. I'm a stickler for words, and a term was used earlier about doctors who would sign up to assisted dying being licensed to kill. Well, can I tell you that I was in the room when we established the Association for Palliative Medicine and then the new specialty of palliative medicine. This is going back to the 1980s. And because we were putting our names to join, my number was 007. So I'm the only doctor in the world that's licensed to kill because I'm a 007. The point I want to make is that actually it is not a license to kill. It's a license to deliver what the patient wants for themselves, deliverance from their sufferance. And it is a complete misnomer and a complete, insult to call that license to kill, because it's basically the patient wanting something to release them from what they know will happen to them. If every doctor that withdrew life support, that actually took away the means to keep people alive, were also licensed to kill. But what about intensivists, intensive care unit doctors who switch off ventilators and heart and lung support machines? Are they licensed to kill? What about neurologists who decide with a patient, with the family of a patient, that the time has come for a patient with motor neurone disease who's on a ventilator but actually still struggling? It's time to take that ventilator off. Is that neurologist licensed to kill? Absolutely not. They're delivering, you know, they're offering deliverance from suffering from their patients. We also heard, I'm a stickler for words, we also heard the term cocktail of drugs come up a few times. Now, I have to say, that's barroom language, which is not befitting of this house, and it's offensive to the people who are working for academically for years to deliver the best forms of pain and symptom control. And I'm recognised as an international expert on cancer pain, and I know that we're still struggling to get the best, the term is regimens. We don't call them cocktails. The only cocktail that's ever applied to end-of-life care was in St. Christopher's Hospice. When Dame Cicely set up St. Christopher's Hospice, the drugs, the thing that they used was called Brompton Cocktail. Some of us might remember Brompton's Cocktail. It was a mixture of diamorphine, heroin, alcohol, a sedative like phenothiazine, and cocaine. That was Brompton's Cocktail. That's the only cocktail that's ever applied. And to his credit, Robert Twycross was a researcher with her, and he did a study, and it showed that you didn't need the alcohol, you didn't need the cocaine. The morphine was good enough. But the point is, we are still struggling to deliver the best, but we've got lots of evidence. And NICE, I chaired the NICE guideline on the last days of life, NG31, 2015. So I know that many of the recommendations we made were based not on hard, you know, pharmacological evidence. They were based on consensus from the people who knew most across the country, who came not just on the committee, the guideline committee, but were drawn in from different specialties. So, yes, medicine is not always evidence-based. We're trying to get there. But actually, we take into consideration consensus of opinion from people who know what they're doing in the front line. So let's not use barroom language. Let's talk about, yes, lack of evidence, but actually we're moving towards that. And what the guidelines we're using now are getting more and more evidence-based. Another term that was used was, there is no need for patients to go screaming to death. The solution we were offered was that actually that patient could then be put under with sedation. Now, putting somebody under sedation is something that is a skillful art, and I was pretty good at it. With palliative proportionate sedation, you can take somebody suffering down to a level, titrate them down till they're no longer complaining, maybe go into a semi-coma, and then a couple of days later you can wake them up, and quite often the pain will be better. Because you've reset the receptors, you know, so pain sort of winds down again. If it builds up, you can always sedate the patient again. That is good end-of-life care, palliative proportionate sedation. I think what was being advocated was sedation to unconsciousness or sedation to death. Now, forgive me, but I think that's not a million miles from what the Netherlands call palliative sedation, which is euthanasia light. It's basically a very sort of a drawn-out version of euthanasia where the doctor sets up a drip and it runs over 2 or 3 days. So it makes them feel better, but that's euthanasia light. This is not what's recommended. But actually, yeah, Association of Palliative Medicine recommends that if patients don't want to carry on living, they can turn their face to the wall, they can stop eating and drinking, and we can also give them sedation. That is not a solution. That's not what patients are really asking. Absolutely undignified. Finally, I just think it's invidious to use descriptions of drugs for execution in the United States against drugs used for assisted dying. I think I don't want to talk about it anymore. I think it's a terrible comparison. Nothing like that, either in the content of the drugs or the intention of the drugs. And I think it's absolutely a shame that we heard that in this house.
Thank you very much. We'll turn now to questions, and I already have quite a list. Starting with Dr. Allenson.
Thank you very much. We've heard a lot about diagnosis, and, you know, poor diagnosis and people not actually expected to die within 6 or 12 months, and also the ability to forecast that. As far as I understand, the extension from the Department of Work and Pensions from 6 to 12 months was that they actually found that doctors probably overestimated somebody's prognosis rather than underestimated it. And so in terms of benefits, by the time people got told they had 6 months to live, often it was far shorter than that. And that's why that extension was made to take in 12 months.
Thank you for making it to the end of the Little Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.